Good afternoon. It is a Monday, May 14th, 2018, 13 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into WWGH Radio. Scott Spears along with you for the ride today. And we have a great show today, and I'm going to get to that momentarily. But I want to do a little bit of housekeeping to all the mothers. I hope everybody had a terrific Mother's Day yesterday. I did, had a lot of fun, and I hope you did as well. Do need to mention that programming today on WWGH Radio is supported by the Friends of Tara Dyer for County Commissioner, a problem solver for Marion's future. So we thank that particular group. Now, here's the guest list for this week in our big, amazing May we have running here. On Thursday, we will be joined at 12:10 by Marion Ross, the mother from the Happy Days. She's got a new book, My Days, Happy and Otherwise. Marion Ross, Thursday at 12:10. 1:10 on Thursday, we have not talked to this gentleman for quite a while. The mayor of Marion, Scott Scherzer, will be along Thursday at 1:10. Wednesday at 1:10, we have the gentleman who's won more Emmy Awards than any other person, male, in the history of the Emmy Awards. Do you know who it is? He's a frequent guest on this program. We haven't had him on since December, but so glad to have him here in the springtime. You probably know him best for his role as Lou Grant on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And Lou Grant, Ed Asner, Wednesday at 1:10. And tomorrow, one of our friends, the amazing Kreskin, has a new prediction he's going to share with us tomorrow at 1:10. Now, today is historic in a way, because the gentleman who sits across from me has never been to the WWGH studios, and to my knowledge, I don't know that any other governor has ever sat down in Marion to do a two-hour live interview on the air. So, a historic day here. And I want to mention really quick that next hour, joining the governor that I have with me, will be 40th Treasurer of the United States, Mary Ellen Withrow. So we'll have a lot of current events to talk about next hour, but the gentleman who's across from me was the 68th governor of the state of Ohio from 2007 to 2011, Ted Strickland. Governor, thank you so much for coming in today.
Scott, I'm so happy to be in Marion and talking with you this morning.
It's always been fun to talk with you. We've done it by phone. We have done it when you were campaigning for the Senate seat. But face-to-face, 2 hours, and Mary Ellen will join us next hour. This is going to be a fun day.
Well, Mary Ellen is a wonderful person, and I love her dearly. She's done so much for Ohio and for the country, and I'm just proud to be on this show with her.
So we will have her about 10 after 1. So we'll save all the current events for that hour, and there's a lot to talk about with the governor's race and everything else going on. But, Governor, I think all the times we've talked, because there's always been something going on, a race, a current event, that we've never talked about you. So I thought we'd reserve this hour, and we'll talk about your life and how you came to be.
Well, it may be a boring hour if we're talking about me.
No, this is fascinating, I think. Where'd you grow up? What was your childhood?
Well, I grew up on a dirt road called Duck Run down in Scioto County, and I went to a one-room school. There were 29 students in that school, 4 grades, and 1 teacher. And Duck Run is a place that I'm very proud of because there are 2 other people who grew up on Duck Run that I think your listeners may know about. One was Roy Rogers.
Oh.
He grew up about a quarter of a mile from where I did. I knew Roy. His real name was Leonard Sly. He left Duck Run as a teenager, went to California, adopted the stage name of Roy Rogers, and became King of the Cowboys. And so I'm proud to have grown up on the same road that he grew up on. But the other person who grew up on Duck Run was the man who integrated Major League Baseball.
Jackie Robinson.
He signed Jackie Robinson to the major leagues.
Branch Rickey.
Branch Rickey grew up on Duck Run. So if you go to Duck Run today, you go up at the head of the hollow. There's a little white frame house that Roy and his father built before they left. And there's a historical plaque there showing the home of Roy Rogers when he was a teenager. And then you go down the road about 4 or 5 miles on Duck Run, and there's another historical plaque with a white frame home where Branch Rickey grew up. So I'm very proud of Duck Run, Ohio.
What was Roy Rogers like?
You know, I did not know him until later in his life. My parents knew him well. And they say when he was a young man, he would ride up and down the road on an old mule. And then he became famous and King of the Cowboys. And he used to come back then when I was like in middle school. And he would have a party up at the place where he grew up. And they would have singing and a lot of drinking and some dancing and all that kind of thing. But when I got to know him personally, he was much older. And in 1980, he came back to Lucasville, Ohio, for a funeral. And I walked around the funeral home with him because I was running for the U.S. House in 1980. And I asked him if he would do a radio commercial for me. I said, Roy, would you do a radio commercial and say, "Hi, this is Roy Rogers. I'm from Duck Run, and I would like you to vote for another guy from Duck Run for the Congress, Ted Strickland." And he said, well, by the way, Roy became a Republican in his later life. He said, well, Ted, I've been trying to stay away from politics. He said, Ronnie has been trying to get me to help him, and I won't help him either. And that's when Ronald Reagan was running for the presidency. So, he was just a down-to-earth guy. He had a lot of trauma in his life, you know, with losing his son and so on. But we're very proud of it. In fact, I have a book about Roy Rogers in my car parked out in your parking lot right now. I'm very proud of the fact that that he came from the same part of the country that I came from.
Absolutely. When you're growing up, what is your ambition in life?
You know, when I was growing up, I really didn't know anyone who went to college. There were 9 kids in my family. I was the youngest son. Only 2 of us finished high school out of the 9 kids. So education wasn't a big thing. My brothers quit school and got a job. My sisters tended to marry very young, as a lot of younger women did back in that time. So I expected that I would do what my father and my brothers did, and that was either work in the steel mill, where my dad worked for 46 years, or finish concrete. 3 of my brothers finished concrete. And, I come from a very working-class family. In fact, I had a niece before she retired who was a cement mason. She finished concrete for a living, and that's hard work. And I was always so proud of her because she everything I ever heard about her work was, boy, she is really good at what she does. Then I had another niece who was a union electrician. And I had a niece who was a union pipe fitter. So I come from a working class family. As I said, 3 of my brothers were concrete finishers. And it wasn't until I was a senior in high school that I had any thought at all about going to college. And so that's the kind of family I came from.
When you got to college, what struck you about college? Nobody had went. What was your impression?
Well, I'll just reveal something about myself. Initially, I didn't go to college to get an education. I went to college because I went to Asbury College, which was a small Christian school in Kentucky. And I just wanted to be in that kind of religious environment. My first quarter, I got four C's, and I was ecstatic. Mm-hmm. Now, most college students wouldn't be happy with four C's. But you see, I had no expectation of going to college. I didn't know what college was all about. And the fact that I got four C's, which those are passing grades, convinced me that I can actually do this. And so the next quarter, I think I got three A's and a B. And it was uphill from, I was on my way. But college was something that was foreign to me. But I took to it, and I ended up with two master's degrees and a PhD degree.
Oh, perfect. When you got out, where did you think you'd work? When you hit the concrete, where did you go?
Well, when I went to college, as I said, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to find some way that I could serve God and humankind. That was my motivation back in those days. But I majored in history and minored in psychology and secondary education. But I never taught high school. I just gave a commencement address at Shawnee State University down in Portsmouth, Ohio. By the way, a great school. If any of your listeners have young men or women in their families looking for a place to go to college, it's a great school, and it's very affordable. But one of the things I said to the graduates in that commencement address was many of the most important things that happen in our lives are not planned. They just happen, and we've got to react to them. And some of the things that happen to us are very good, and sometimes things that happen to us are painful. I really didn't know what I was going to do. But after I finished college, I got a grant to study psychology at the University of Kentucky. And while I was going to school, I started doing some volunteer work at a children's home, a Methodist children's home near Lexington, Kentucky. And so after I finished my master's in counseling, I also attended theological seminary for 3 years. And I was ordained a United Methodist minister, and I was in a church in Portsmouth, Ohio. And then the bishop asked me if I would go back to the children's home where I had previously worked. And I did that for a number of years. And then I was working with kids who had a lot of problems. Many of them had been terribly abused and neglected in different ways. And I determined I needed to know more about how to deal with these kinds of problems. And so I went back to the University of Kentucky and pursued my PhD in psychology. And then I finished that. I came back to Ohio. I went to Columbus. I did a year of postdoc internship so that I could sit for the licensure, became a licensed psychologist, and worked in community mental health and worked in a large state psychiatric hospital. And I did that for a few years. And then because I was from Lucasville, Ohio, I was aware of the prison there, obviously. And I was contacted, and they were saying to me, you know, we really need psychological help because a lot of the prisoners that are in our jails and prisons are people who suffer from serious mental illnesses. And so they asked me if I would spend at least one day a week at the prison. And I started doing that, and then I got a teaching job at Shawnee State University, and I was teaching full-time, and then I was working 20 hours a week at the prison. I was elected to Congress in 1992.
Working at the prison, that's fascinating. When you were talking to the prisoners, what did you find was going on there? Why had they done what they had done?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you see a little bit of everything in a prison, especially a maximum security prison like we had at Lucasville. You see a lot of young people who are serving long sentences, in part because of drug involvement. And so you see a little bit of everything, but you see a lot of very serious mental illness in these prisons. Schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depressions, anxiety disorders of one kind or another. And Lucasville was a pretty violent place, almost on a weekly, maybe even a daily basis. You saw a lot of blood and, you know, and assaults, usually inmates on other, you know, assaulting other inmates. But it was a challenging place, but I'm glad I did it because I think it gives me an insight into life that some people never experience. You know, prisons, by their very nature, are shut off from the larger society. But within these prisons, it's like an internal community, and it's there's a lot of sadness that you see in these prisons.
You talked about working in state hospitals. They were closed. Did you think that was a good idea? There's a lot of discussion about that even to this day.
Well, the idea behind it was a noble idea. And the idea was this. Instead of people being shut off in these large, impersonal state facilities and living out their lives there, why don't we provide treatment in the local communities so that they can be closer to their homes and their families and so on and still get the treatment they need? It was a good idea, but it didn't work out so well because the money did not follow the patients into these communities. And so a lot of these folks who had spent maybe decades in these large state facilities were placed back into the local community. Many of them did not have family supports. The treatment, the appropriate treatment, was not available. So they ended up on the streets, sleeping under bridges. Many of them died, and many, many of them committed infractions, sometimes small, and urinating in public, for example. If you're mentally ill, and you've got to go to the bathroom, you know, you might do it in some public environment, or criminal trespass, being where they shouldn't be, and they were caught up into the criminal justice system, and we now have the largest mental health treatment facilities in America are our jails and prisons, not hospitals and clinics. And it's a sad, sad thing because it's tough to live in prison even if you have your right mind. But if you've got serious mental illnesses and you're in that kind of environment, it's just tragic.
There is a discussion, and we've had it a lot here on this station. If you commit murder, that is an illogical thought. Logical people don't murder people. So when somebody says, I plead insanity, wouldn't you have to be to commit murder?
You know, I'm speaking here as a former psychologist and clinician, and I think no.
No.
No. I think a person can have the ability to think, to control their emotions and their mental processes and still engage in that kind of behavior. But the sad thing is there are a lot of people in our jails and prisons who should not be there. They should be in a place where they can be supervised and appropriately cared for. I talk about this a lot. I just taught a course at the Harvard School of Public Health this past winter, and I spent quite a bit of time talking about this issue and what's happening within our jails and prisons in terms of people who have serious mental illnesses. And, it's an issue that should trouble all of us. Because when people are sick, and mental illness is a disease, it's an illness. And people who suffer from schizophrenia are worthy of treatment just as if someone has cancer or diabetes. And oftentimes we look at the behaviors that result from mental illness and we make a judgment about the person based on the behavior. But that behavior can be and oftentimes is a direct result of the illness that the person is suffering.
I think the listeners will remember this because the one that comes to my mind, it was called the Scarsdale Diet Doctor, and he was dating a very well-known headmistress up, I think, in Connecticut. This was in the early 80s. And she found him with another woman, and she shot him, and he ended up dying.
Mm-hmm.
And they put her in prison for murder. And I remember reporters were going to the Governor Cuomo at that time and saying, commute her sentence. She was not in the right frame of mind when she did that. And eventually she was let out of prison.
You know, the legal standard to use the insanity defense is very high. It is seldom successful, the insanity defense. I think that's true in part because a lot of people don't understand mental illness. Even people who are legislators or attorneys and so on don't understand. And there are different forms of mental illness, obviously. As you know, the major illnesses are schizophrenia and major depression and bipolar disorder and so on. And I've worked with people who have had all of these conditions and problems. One of the things that really bothers me about what's happening today in terms of the shootings that we're seeing is that I think mentally ill people are being made scapegoats. You know, these politicians, rather than talk about what I think needs to be talked about, and that's violent behavior and the use of guns, it's easy for them to say, oh, it's the mental illness problem that's causing all of this. Mentally ill people are much less likely to be dangerous than, much more likely to be victims of violence, let's put it that way, than to be perpetrators of violence. And to say, well, it's a result of mental illness, some of it is, obviously, and we ought to make sure that people who have these serious conditions do not have access to firearms. But there's much more we ought to do in dealing with this gun violence issue than simply focus on people with mental illnesses.
The current governor's election and the governor's primary, the NRA and ratings and guns became a big issue. So I'm going to couch that when Mary Ellen, and we're going to bring that back up because I think that's important. But coming back to your life, you're an ordained Methodist minister. Tell me, I know this is complicated, but how did that happen? Was there a calling? Did you feel the need to do it? How did that come?
Well, religious faith was so important to me, especially at that time in my young life, and I wanted to find some way to serve, and I felt that was how I could serve. And like I say, I was at a church for 1 year, and then the bishop said, you know, you worked at this children's home. They'd like for you to come back and be a part of the administration. So I was the campus chaplain as well as the campus director of that facility. And I ended up spending a lot of my years there. My very best friend today is a fellow who's a pediatric surgeon in Orlando, Florida, and he was a young kid when I went to work at that children's home. And I still, you know, after all these decades, I still stay in touch with many of those young people. Of course, they're not young anymore. Many of them are facing retirement even. But it was a wonderful part of my life, a wonderful time in my life. And I feel about these kids who grew up there, many of them, as if, you know, they're extensions of my own family.
Psychologist, minister, how did politics come into this?
Well, some people ask that question, but I tell you, I think there's a continuity to what I've done. You know, minister, child care worker, psychologist, politician. I think the common thread is serving people. That's what I've tried to do throughout my life, in various ways, in various jobs and roles and so on. But the idea of feeling as if I've got a responsibility to serve people has been a part of my life. I think I probably learned that from my mother more than anyone else.
You won some offices, lost some offices.
I have. I've won and lost.
Won and lost. You've been on both sides. But in 2006, you decide to run for governor. How does that come about?
Well, I was in my office in Washington when I was in the House of Representatives, and I got a call from Senator Harry Reid. And I had never met Senator Reid, but he said, "Congressman, would you come over to my office? I'd like to talk with you." So I went over to the Senate side, and when I got there, he was in his office, but he had Senator Stabenow from Michigan, Senator Schumer from New York, and Senator Durbin from Illinois. And they said, "We've been looking at your background, and we think you'd be a good candidate for the Senate." And I said, "Well, I've never really thought about the Senate, but would you do some polling for me to see if, you know, it might be reasonable for me to do this?" So they did a poll, and it came back, looked pretty hopeful. And my chief of staff at the time was a guy from Athens, Ohio, by the name of John Haisley. And John had worked in the Senate with Senator John Glenn. So he knew the Senate, he knew the House, and as we were talking, John said, "Well, Ted, if you're willing to take a chance and leave the House, why don't you run for governor instead of the Senate?" Because he said a governor can do things that a legislator can't do. So I decided to run for governor.
Tell me about election night 2006. When they say Ted Strickland is the next governor of Ohio.
Yeah, you feel incredible responsibility. You know, Ohio has about 11.5 million people. It's a very complex state. We've got big cities, small towns, rural areas. We've got Appalachia. We've got wonderful farmland. We've got big industry, small industry. And to know that you're going to be the governor of Ohio is something that I think you take very seriously, and I took it very seriously.
One of the things in Ohio, we are a death penalty state, and yes, you did commute some sentences, but some people were put to death while you were governor.
Yes.
What is that like? How do you make those decisions?
Before I decided to run for governor, I had to come to grips with that issue. I personally think we ought not to have a death penalty. I think probably innocent people have been killed. I don't know if that's happened in Ohio, but I really believe it's happened elsewhere, especially Texas. So I wish we didn't have a death penalty. If it was my decision, I would say, you know, we're just not going to do this. One of the people that I commuted, I didn't turn him loose. I commuted him from death to life in prison without parole. His name is Kevin Keith. I commuted him 15 days before he would have been executed. I now feel that he is very likely to be innocent. There are efforts being made right now to get him a second trial, not to turn him loose, but just to get him a second trial. Because I believe, looking at the evidence, as I have even very recently, that there are questions about his guilt. And so the death penalty is so final. You can't correct a mistake. I just think it does not serve Ohio or humanity.
In the last 15 years, I think there has been more talk of this than the prior time, but there was always talk about the separation of church and state. Were your political duties ever at odds with your religious beliefs being a Methodist minister?
Just let me say, I absolutely believe in the constitutional guarantee that that we are a secular society, and that there should be no religious test either for a person who believes or does not believe. And I am really troubled at what I see happening in our country today, where religion is being interjected into our political life in a way that I think is bad for religion and organized religion, and I think it's tragic for our democracy. When you take the oath of office to uphold the Constitution, that's your obligation. And if you ever come to a point where your religious belief prevents you from functioning in that way, then you need to recognize it and, if necessary, leave the office.
Reflection is an interesting thing we can do now. We can look back. While you were governor, some interesting things happened. A big one was the theft of the government computer in 2007. Lots of information, thousands of people's information was compromised, I guess is the term you would say. When you heard about that, what did you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just talking with a fellow who was in my administration about this a couple of days ago. I am so proud of how we handled that. What happened was a young intern took home a disk. Shouldn't have happened, but he put it in his car, forgot to take it into his apartment. His car was broken into and the disk was stolen. So immediately upon hearing that that happened, I called my staff together and I said, we are going to be totally transparent about this. So we got the word out as quickly as it was possible. We said, this has happened. We don't know what's happened to that disk. We don't know if it'll be used in bad ways or not. It never was, but we immediately then took out insurance to cover anyone who may have suffered harm as a result of that, and so of all the things, I mean, I did a lot of things that I'm proud of, but I am so proud that we handled that immediately and we handled it in a transparent way, and we told the public exactly what happened and what we were going to do to keep them from being harmed as a result.
In 2008, I remember this, we're having a presidential election. You're early in your term as governor, and there was a lot of talk about Ted Strickland being Barack Obama's vice presidential candidate. How far did that go?
You know, I first of all, Hillary had, you know, there was some indication that she, if she had been successful, would have been interested in me. I tried to throw cold water on that as quickly as possible and as definitively as possible. I was governor. I was wanting to focus on that. And I just really did not want to get caught up in all of that you know, speculation, and it is very distracting. That kind of stuff can be very distracting. And I just tried to put a stop to that speculation as quickly as I could.
In 2012, I believe you were working on the committee at the Democratic Convention, and it was 2008 or 2012. I'm trying to remember the year. And you wanted God in the wording. Am I correct on this?
Well, there was a first of all, I was chair of the platform drafting committee, but I was not chair of the committee itself.
Okay.
And at the beginning of the convention, it was called to the attention of some of the leaders of the convention that there had been an omission. And I was asked if I would make a motion from the floor, which I agreed to do, to correct two things in the platform. One was the you know, the mention of God in the platform, and the other was a statement regarding our support for the state of Israel. And so I made that motion at the convention.
It caused a little bit of a hubbub at that time. I remember there was some news of it. Did you think it was something that should have garnered the attention that it did?
Not really. It was not something that I considered, you know, a big deal at all. It was just a correction of the language of the platform that should not have been controversial at all.
2010. It was time for election again. Mm-hmm. You run, our current governor, Kasich, at that time, John Kasich, was the Republican opposition. How did you feel going into that election season?
I felt like I should be reelected, and I felt like I deserved to be reelected because I had dealt with the Great Recession that I did not cause. You know, then candidate, current governor Kasich, accused me of losing 350,000 jobs. He failed to mention that America had lost millions of jobs. And of course, Ohio lost jobs during that recession as well. What caused the recession? The recession was caused by greed, largely by big banks and Wall Street. And who was working for a big bank at the time? It was then John Kasich, who was working for Lehman Brothers, which was the failure of Lehman Brothers that actually set off the cascade of events that led to the Great Recession. And I felt like I had dealt with that recession responsibly. I tried to protect education. I tried to do everything I could to make sure that Ohioans weren't damaged any more than was necessary as a result of the recession. So I felt like I deserved reelection. But the people decided otherwise, and I tried to graciously accept their decision. I don't think anyone ever heard me, you know, feel sorry for myself or complain that that somehow the people of Ohio had treated me unfairly.
Going into that November night in 2010, I remember it was not a slam dunk either way. It was very close. What was that day like for you? I can't imagine going through something like that.
Well, I was working right up until the end. I remember the last stop I made campaign-wise was in Zanesville, Ohio. And it was getting later into the evening. And I stopped in Zanesville for, you know, for one last a little rally there in Zanesville. But I've gone through a lot in my life, and I've lost people that I love, and I try to keep things in perspective. And so the thing that disappointed me most about not being reelected, was that I had wonderful people working for me who were serving the state really well. And, of course, when I lost, then they lost their positions as well.
What is that 3-month period like from Election Day till you know you're going to be leaving in January?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, you work with the victor very closely. Resources are made available to the winner to set up a transition office. And so my attitude was, whatever we can do to make this transition smooth, and by the way, Governor Taft did the same thing for me when he left office. He's a wonderful fella. I really admire Bob Taft a lot, and his wife Hope. They're just wonderful people.
Did he get a bad rap?
He did. He got a bad rap.
To this day.
To this day, you know, they say he took gifts or something, played golf without reporting it. Bob Taft is a wealthy man, but Bob Taft is an honorable man, and his wife is just a wonderful person. My wife Frances and her have a good friendship, and yeah, Bob Taft's a good man. I don't agree with him politically, but I think he's a good person.
Your last day in office, what did you do as governor?
Well, there's certain responsibilities that you have as you are leaving office and you're turning things over, because at a moment in time, you're no longer the governor and the new guy is. And that usually happens at midnight. I took office when I took office I took the oath at midnight, and the first thing I did was sign an ethics executive order limiting what people who worked in my administration could take, I forget what the number was. I think it was nothing more than $25 over a year, something like that. But it was a very requirement. I wish we had it now, and we wouldn't have, you know, the Speaker of the House resigning under a cloud and because he's hobnobbing with payday lenders and taking vacations in wherever, Paris or somewhere, you know. That could not have happened under my administration. Oh, that was totally, totally forbidden, that kind of activity. But and then I went back to the House, and I had a party at the residence with, you know, with my friends, and at the stroke of midnight we knew we had to have everything out. So we were taking everything out of the house in the middle of the night so that it would be ready for the new governor.
And I think it's been empty ever since, has it not, the governor's mansion?
Yeah, I regret that. I really do. I first of all, I think it's been costly for Ohio taxpayers, because Governor Kasich's decision to not live in the governor's residence means the governor's residence still has to be kept up, and there still has to be security there. But there also has to be security where he's living, and I think that's been very costly and expensive.
We have about 5 minutes left in this hour, but we're not letting the governor go here, and Mary Ellen Withrow should be joining us in the next hour. Do want to remind everybody, this hour of programming is supported by the Friends of Tara Dyer for County Commissioner, a problem solver for a Marion's future. We've covered this a lot. There's a picture I brought out today, yeah, covering your Senate race back in 2016. In early 2016, Donald Trump is headed for the Republican nomination. It looks like the Republican Party's in disarray. It looks like Hillary Clinton's going to be president. It looks like Ted Strickland is a shoe-in because the Republicans are in trouble. It's going to be a Democratic year. Hillary Clinton wrote the book. What happened in November?
Well, it was a strange year. You know, at the beginning of that race, my race with Senator Portman, I was leading in the polls, and I was leading, or even up to about August. But Scott, they spent about $60 million against me, and most of that did not come from Senator Portman. Senator Portman spent his money saying good things about him, but the special interests came in, the Koch brothers especially. And trash me. And it was politics, I think, at its worst. But I try not to have a bad attitude about it. But we've got to get money out of politics. You know, when billionaires can spend whatever they want to spend, it's going to destroy our democracy. It really is. And the Supreme Court made that terrible decision, Citizens United, that said money is speech. And that means if you've got a lot of money, you've got a lot more speech than the average person. And they said corporations have the same status as people. But corporations, a corporation doesn't have a conscience. A corporation has a responsibility to increase shareholder value, not to do what's right for the common good of society. And I think it was a devastating decision by the court. I think it really threatens our democracy as we have known it.
And we'll talk about that next hour with Mary Ellen as well. That's something else we'll save. But 100 years from now, in your obituary, what do you want the first line to read? What is the thing you are proudest of in the career?
Oh, in my career?
In the career.
The fact that I provided honest service. I came into office a relatively poor man, and I have everything I need, but I'm leaving office. I left office not as a rich man, and I'm proud of that.
Do you 2016? You did not win against Senator Portman. Do you ever think, I'd like to do that again?
Probably not. No. I'm doing everything I can to help Rich Cordray become the next governor. He's a good person. He's so smart, so talented, and will be such a good governor. And so I want to spend my efforts in helping others that I think will be good public servants.
The guest today for the two-hour program is the 68th governor of the state of Ohio, Ted Strickland. 40th treasurer of the United States, Mary Ellen Withrow, will join us in about 15 minutes. Remember, this hour again of programming supported by the Friends of Tara Dyer for County Commissioner, a problem solver for Marion's future. Next hour, we're going to talk about Trump and Cordray and everything. Oh, and Mary Ellen is coming in. We're going to go to break. We'll be back with Mary Ellen Withrow and the governor. Stay tuned.
Is anything private?
No, not much is private, but I'm a